dear colleagues and friends. So it's a pleasure for us to welcome Professor Barnatan from the University of Toronto, who has accepted to give the Villa Vallée-Poussin series of lectures of this year. Before introducing him, let me just remind you quickly about the Baron Charles Jean de la Vallée-Poussin, an impressive portrait of whom you can see on the wall at our...
Hi.
Okay, thanks. He was a professor at the UCL since 1891, where he stayed for more than 60 years, and he has become worldwide known as a mathematician in 1896, when he proved the theorem on the asymptotic distribution of prime numbers. So the picture and the theorem is back there, if you want to accuse about it. I will now say a few words about Professor Barnatan. So, after finishing his undergrad great studies in mathematics in Tel Aviv, he moved to Princeton in 1987 to do a PhD in mathematics under the supervision of the physicist Edward Newton. He earned his PhD degree in 1991 and then spent the next 4 years in Harvard as an assistant professor before moving to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where he stayed as an associate professor until 2002. After a short period as invited professor at the University of California in Berkeley, he moved to the University of Toronto, where he is currently professor of mathematics. Professor Barnatan has done influential work in low-dimensional topology and knot theory, more specifically in the theory of finite type invariance and in the formalization of Kovanov homology. One of his main interests at the moment is the study of knotted objects. In particular, knotted two-dimensional objects in force space and how they connect to other parts of mathematics. In particular, universal theory, Feynman diagrams, which will be part of this week's course. Besides his innovative research and influential yet unique way of describing mathematics, Professor Barnatan is also known to be the founder and one of the main contributors of the Knot Atlas, the most comprehensive existing database of information on knots and their invariants. He is also known for his talent in computer programming. This in particular includes the program Knot Theory, an important computer package to deal with knot invariants. It would be tempting and fun to find connections between Professor Barnatan and Charles de la Vallée-Poussin. A natural place to look is to try to find some work of Charles de la Vallée-Poussin in topology, a field where mathematicians were making the first early steps at that time. A first look at his bibliography seems to suggest that de la Vallée-Poussin never published in topology. But that's not completely true, because he wrote a note, a very short note about the four-color theorem. So you all know that this theorem states that four colors suffice to paint a map in the plane such that any two adjacent regions have different colors. Alfred Kempe gave a first proof of this theorem, but in his note, de la Vallée-Poussin pointed a serious flaw in Kempe's proof and claimed that, quoting, "This error seems not to be easy to fix." That is contribution to topology. Now, if you scroll through Professor Barnatan's publication list,
you have it there? Oh, I put it there. The way to find the connection between any two things is to Google them together. So I tried Googling myself and De la Vallée-Poussin, and I only got this series of
There's one more connection.
Yeah.
So if you scroll down Professor Barnatan's publication list, you'll find a paper called Lie algebras and the four-color theorem. This paper contains a statement about Lie algebras that is equivalent to the four-color theorem. I will not say more about the four-color theorem. If you have questions about this connection, you can ask afterwards. So, ergo, even if de la Vallée-Poussin never really worked in topology, I'm sure that he would have been very interested in the relations between knotted objects, the algebras, and quantum field theory that Professor Weinstein will explain to us this week. Now, all of us are very impatient to listen to the fascinating mathematics, and I thank in advance Professor Weinstein for giving us this opportunity.
So, thanks for inviting me, and thanks for introducing me. And there was a transposition between two places that I've been to, but it doesn't really matter. And the Knot Atlas, it had fallen recently into disrepair. It's a website, right? But if you don't maintain a website, it goes, decays. And I've been too busy, and so has been my main collaborator, Scott Morrison, and I genuinely and truly regret it. But anyway, let's start. So for today, or for this series of talks, I'm going to tell you about expansions. So, you know, things like the Taylor expansion, but somewhat generalized. And I should say that all five lectures will be at a level that a graduate student should follow. So everything should be at a very basic level. And this has a good and a bad, or maybe two sides of bad, and I wish to apologize for both of them. So on one hand, possibly at some point, everything will be a tiny bit too sketchy. And such is life, I don't know, I have to apologize. And the other thing is that there is lots and lots and lots of wonderful things that I will not get to. And again, I apologize. But you know, some of these things are in my list of publications, I suppose a bit further up. And some of these things, well, I'll just skip and, you know, maybe one day get the chance to talk about them. Maybe next week in some sort of informal forum, but we'll see. Okay, let me start. So my talk will follow a handout, and here it is in front of you. And today's talk, I will describe the general expansions machine. So expansions for this week are a machine. They take as input some topic in topology, and I will explain what I mean by that a little later on, and produce as output a problem in algebra. Sometimes interesting, sometimes not, sometimes with solutions, sometimes not. Sometimes it's very hard to analyze the transition between topology and algebra. But in principle, it's a machine that takes as input problems in topics in topology and produces as outputs problems in algebra. And I will illustrate it by one example. And the example is where the input is a certain class of two-dimensional knotted objects, so not quite two-dimensional knots in R4, but slightly more general than just knots in R4, but the topology of knotted things in R4, and then the output will be the so-called Kashiwara-Verne problem, which is a problem about convolutions on Lie groups and Lie algebras. But I'll start by describing the problem, and it will be very sketchy, and don't worry, because at this point you don't need to understand anything more than the sketch, because later I will get back to it, or to some extent, I will get back to it. It will become less sketchy later. Anyway, the problem, the Kashiwara-Verne problem, and later I will tell you how it relates to topology, is to find a pair of power series F and G in the completed freely algebra on two generators. So the freely algebra is denoted, maybe that was too ambitious, is denoted FL, and I'm looking for two power series F and G in this freely algebra generated by X and Y. Let me explain what it means. So what's a freely algebra? So first of all, do I need to remind people what a Lie algebra is? So a Lie algebra is a vector space L along with a bracket
which is simply a map from L times L into L, which is bilinear, anti-symmetric, so the bracket of xy plus the bracket of yx is equal to zero. And finally, it satisfies the Jacobi identity, so the bracket of x with the bracket of y and z plus all cyclic permutations of the same thing has to be zero. Now, Lie algebras are extremely important, you know. Sorry, it's very hard to overestimate. They are infinitesimal symmetries of anything. So symmetries are Lie groups, and if you look at sort of the infinitesimal version of symmetries, where you just move epsilon in some direction, what you get are Lie algebras. So fully understanding Lie algebras and its representations is about half of mathematics. Okay. Now what's a free Lie algebra? So a free Lie algebra on a number of generators, well, I'll only need two, x and y, is, well, the Lie algebra that contains x and y, and everything else that is forced by having a Lie algebra structure with nothing else and no other relations imposed. Okay? So basically, it would have to contain formal linear combinations of x and y, so the vector space generated by x and y, but they will not bother to indicate it. But then since x and y are in, it will also have to contain the bracket of x and y. And since I never said anything about it, the bracket is just a new element. And then it will have to contain, well, in principle, the bracket of y and x. But since I have anti-symmetry, this is the same as that, or maybe it's the negative of that, so I don't need to write it as a new element. But I do need to write the bracket of x with the bracket of x and y, and maybe more and more and more and more and more things, and in fact, infinitely many things. So it's an infinite dimensional space, and of course I need to take all possible linear combinations of these things, and I just declare the bracket to be the formal bracket. Given two constructions like that, their bracket will be just put a bracket around. Okay? And you mod out by exactly the anti-symmetry relation. I already explained how to mod out by it, but also by the Jacobi relation. So basically, you declare that if you cyclically permute the things that appear here, you get zero. That's the free Lie algebra. A different way to understand the free Lie algebra is to understand it as a collection of trees. So you see, this can be represented by a tree that has a root at the bottom, and then x and y at the top, and you read the vertex as being the bracket of x and y. This can be represented as a slightly bigger tree in which you have at the top x and y, their bracket flows into another bracket, namely the bracket with x, and then the root is here. And basically, you can view the free Lie algebra as a big space made out of many, many trees, modulus on relations. Okay? One additional point, the free Lie algebra is graded. So every generator of the free Lie algebra has a degree. The degree is just the number of times every vector space generator of the free Lie algebra has a degree, and the degree is the number of times one of the basic generators appears in it, x and y. So this will be an element of degree 2, this will be an element of degree 3, and I'll have additional elements of course of higher degrees. So when I say that f and g are elements of the complete free Lie algebra, what I mean is that they are infinite. F and G are both infinite linear combinations of trees, modulus on relations that really represent the Jacobi and the anti-symmetry relations. And these are infinite linear combinations in which the degree is allowed to grow. So at any finite degree, you have only finitely many terms, but the degree is allowed to grow. Much like Taylor series are completed polynomials. There are infinite sums, but in which the degree can grow. Okay. Now, sorry, this is not yet the Kashiwara-Verne problem. This is just the input. The two unknowns are series F and G. Now, these two unknowns have to satisfy two equations. One equation is written over here, and it's a mess to even interpret it, and at the moment, all I want you to understand is that it's an equation, okay? But the equation reads, you know, x plus y plus the logarithm of e to the y times e to the x, and it turns out that this can be interpreted in itself as a big power series made out of trees, is equal to, well, something made out of the trees F by combining it with further elements, and something made out of the trees in G. And this equation is in the Frehley algebra, in itself is an equation written in the Frehley algebra. And then there is a second equation, and interpreting it is even harder, and I even less want you to do it right now. But let me just indicate that it's an equation written not quite in the Frehley algebra, but in some other space called the space of cyclic words. The space of cyclic words in X and Y is basically, this, again, it's a space of diagrams, modulo sum relations. And the diagrams are circles with hair, where the hair is labeled X, Y, X, 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 Y, whatever. So this is essentially a word in the letters X and Y, except it's cyclic. Okay, it doesn't have a particular beginning point or a particular end point. Okay? And in this story, there is some linear, this trace of blah, blah, blah. There is some functional that maps from the Frehley algebra two cyclic words. And the functional goes roughly as follows. So if you have an element in the Frehley algebra, you and it is labeled x, x, y, x, y, whatever, then the functional is defined by summing over all possible ways of linking the root to one of the leaves. And then what you get is a cycle with some letters drawn on it, but in addition, some tree parts, which you will have to believe me, the relations annihilate, or not quite annihilate, but allow you to rewrite them so that at the end you get cyclic words. Okay? Now, again, at this point I'm very, very sketchy, but the only further point I wanted to make is that the second equation is written in this space of cyclic words. Okay. These two equations imply a statement which I am very, very loosely stating right now. The statement is more detailed, has some analysis going into it, but very roughly speaking, the statement says that convolutions of invariant functions on a Lie group agrees with convolutions of invariant functions on its Lie algebra. So what does it mean? A Lie group, well, is a topological group, locally compact, whatever. So it has a Haar measure, so it makes sense to take the convolution of two functions, and that defines an algebra. Likewise, and then you can restrict it to invariant functions, invariant under the adjoint action of the group on itself, and then it's a commutative algebra. Likewise, the Lie algebra is a vector space, so it has a Lebesgue measure, and and again, you can take convolutions of functions on that vector space. And if you restrict your attention to invariant functions, then the claim is that this is more or less the same as the algebra of before, of functions on the Lie group. Okay? Now, it's obviously a structural theorem. It's obviously a theorem that if you're interested in Lie groups and Lie algebras, you should be interested in it. And let me indicate very, very briefly how it is conceivable that these two statements are related. Okay? And again, this is completely at the level of sketch. So, basically, you need to show that two integrals are equal. So f convolved with g computed on the group and then pulled to the algebra, and you pull f and g to the algebra and convolve them on the group, on the algebra, sorry. So you have to show that two integrals are equal. The trick is to find a measure-preserving transformation which pulls one integrand to the other. If you're able to find a measure-preserving transformation that takes one integrand to the other, then the two integrals are equal. How do you find a measure-preserving transformation on some, well, it turns out to be a product of the Lie algebra by itself? Well, you find a vector field whose flow is that measure-preserving transformation. And then this vector field has to have two properties. One property is it has to pull one function to the other, and the second property, it has to be divergence-free. It must have no divergence, so that the flow it will generate will be measure-preserving. So I'm looking for a vector field that satisfies two equations. Now, that vector field, I'm looking for a vector field like that, which makes sense in an arbitrary Lie algebra. On any Lie algebra whatsoever, I should be able to find such a vector field. And the idea is to find a universal formula for this vector field. You simply, instead of finding the vector field, I'll find a formula for it. Now, what's an element of the free Lie algebra? An element of the free Lie algebra is a formula that makes sense in any specific Lie algebra. Because if you have a specific Lie algebra, you can feed into such a tree an element x and an element y, and what you got is a formula with output again in the Lie algebra. So you can interpret these pair of things, f and g, as being a formula for a vector field. And then under this interpretation, the two equations become exactly the two equations I want. One equation becomes the fact that one function is pulled to the other, and the second equation involving traces and wheels becomes the divergence is equal to zero. Okay? So that was completely at the level of sketch. I only wanted to make it sound plausible, and I hope it sounds plausible. Okay? I will become a bit more concrete, not more concrete, but more down to earth in a second, because now I want to start with the other side and tell you about the machine. Okay? So the machine is in fact much more general. The input for the machine is not necessarily a problem in topology or a topic in topology, but in fact it could be anything, any algebraic structure. The algebraic structures that I will actually use are algebraic structures which code topological objects. Okay? But the thing is much more general, and let me start with an example. So let G be a group, arbitrary group, any group whatsoever. So given any group, let K be the group ring of that group. So it's the set of all linear combinations of elements of the group, formal linear combinations of elements of the group with coefficients in the rationals. And then within this group ring, let I be the so-called augmentation ideal. So it's the set of all linear combinations whose sum of coefficients is equal to zero. You can check it's an ideal. The moment you have an ideal, it automatically defines a series of further ideals. Namely, you can take the powers of this ideal. Okay? And then and you get a nested sequence of ideals to check that I to the zero, which is hereby declared to be the group ring itself, contains I squared, so maybe I'll call this I to the one, contains I cubed, contains I to the fourth, and so on. And the moment I have a nested sequence of ideal, I can make the so-called associated graded. So I can take the formal infinite, the formal infinite direct sum of the adjacent quotient. So I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1. And it's easy to check that since G was a group, this A, this infinite, the associated graded, it has a product too. And now the key definition. So I'm going to define what an expansion is. So an expansion is a linear function Z defined on the group ring with values in A such that for any element in the ideal to the power m, if you evaluate, right, Z is defined on K and the ideal to the power m is a power of K, so if you evaluate Z on this element gamma, well, the result being inside an infinite direct sum should be an infinitely long sequence of things, one in each component. So this sequence should be 0, 0, 0, 0 until you reach degree m. In degree m, the term that you see is I to the m divided by I to the m plus 1. Now gamma was in I to the m, so I want this element to be the thing that you see in degree m, I want it to be gamma modulo I to the m plus 1, so the equivalent class of gamma in I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1. And I don't care what happens afterwards. Star means anything, like in Unix. Okay? Now, furthermore, a homomorphic expansion is an expansion that takes, right, it's a map from K to A and both have a product. So a homomorphic expansion is an expansion that takes the product here to the product, that intertwines the two products. Okay? And if this sounds mysterious, let me give you example zero. Okay? So here is example zero. It's slightly different. I mean, it's to make it look exactly the same, I have to modify it a tiny bit, and I don't want to waste your time with it. So let K be the ring C infinity of R to the n. So all smooth functions on R to the n. And let I, well, instead of being the augmentation ideal, I could make it look like the augmentation ideal by taking some Fourier transforms, but let's not bother with it right now. So the ideal, instead of the augmentation ideal, I will consider the ideal of all functions that vanish at zero. Yes? Okay? Now, then I to the m, that was a mistake, you know, it was nicely reachable. Okay, sorry. So, can you see it even if I'm... Okay, so I to the m is then functions that vanish m times at zero, right? And then I to the m modulo I to the m plus ones is functions that vanish m times, but I don't care about functions that vanish more than m times. But this is exactly polynomials, homogeneous polynomials of degree m. Now, if I take the direct sum, complete the direct sum of all of these I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1, I get exactly power series. So Z is supposed to be a function from K, so from C infinity to power series. And the first example that comes to mind is the Taylor expansion. And exercise for you, you can check that the Taylor expansion is indeed an expansion in the sense I have defined above. So this is in some sense a vast generalization of the Taylor expansion. It makes sense in any group whatsoever. Are you with me? Does it make sense? Okay. Now I should say that this doesn't define uniquely the Taylor expansion, but I could add some properties. In fact, there is also a co-product, whatever that is, and if I want an expansion which is both homomorphic and co-homomorphic, it's actually, then in this context, it defines the Taylor expansion uniquely. So this genuinely is a generalization of the Taylor expansion. And it makes sense completely arbitrarily, in ridiculous generality. Okay. Questions, comments? Okay, so let's continue. Just for fun, here's another perspective on expansions. So maybe I'll lower it a bit. Yes, so, you know, here's a different view of what an expansion could mean. So let K be the set of all two-dimensional projections of reality. So, namely pictures. So you can think of a picture as being, you know, many light sources, or a linear combination of many light sources. So in some sense, it's the group ring, or it's Q times R2. So it's all linear former linear combinations of points in R2, where, in fact, I made it Q cubed because I want the light sources to have color. But really, it's just you know, combinations of little light bulbs at various points in R2. Okay? Now, you can mod out by various ideals or subspaces, basically declarations that you don't care about certain things. So at first, you can mod out by all points of R2 are considered equal. Then you mod out, so this is K1. Now, K2 is a smaller, you mod out by less. Namely, you only declare that points that belong to the same quadrant are equal. In K3, you only declare that points that belong to the same, whatever, smaller size cube are equal. Okay? And if you look at your picture inside any one of these quotients, you see sort of a finer and finer description of reality. At first, you see just a brown, gray rectangle. I don't know what this red dot is. It's not related to me. And then sort of if you mod out by less and less, the picture emerges. Okay? Now, what's an expansion from this perspective? So, an expansion is, you remember the old times when computers had modems and you would connect to the web and pictures would start up, you know, you would download a picture and a picture would start appearing, and first it would appear at low resolution and then it would appear at higher and higher and higher resolution. So the computer was transmitting to you the information which comes in further and further. So basically, first it would transmit this information, then it would transmit the extra information that this picture has beyond this, then it would transmit the extra information that this picture has beyond this, and then, so at each stage it would transmit the further information that in the that appears in that stage. Now, what does it mean? It means that in stage, three or four, I lost the count, okay? What the computer wants to transmit is whatever lives in the kernel of K mod K4 into K mod K3, right? Because whatever is K in K mod K3 was already transmitted, so you only need to transmit whatever is in the kernel, okay? But this kernel is isomorphic to K3 mod K4. So in day N, the computer is transmitting the information in kn modulo kn plus 1. So the computer is essentially expanding the picture relative to this filtration. Okay? Now, pictures have naturally defined operations on them, right? You can rotate, you can color correct, you can, I don't know what else, put two pictures side by side. And then a homomorphic expansion would be an expansion which is compatible with all of these operations. Okay, so in other words, again, this is sort of a metaphor, an analogy. You should be thinking that in a minute I will start looking at topology, and I will want to look at topology first in a very, very coarse perspective, and then on day two I will be looking at it with a less coarse perspective, and sort of at day end, the more I progress with time, I will have a finer and finer view of the topology I want to look at. Okay? Good. So one further comment. Suppose your group was finitely presented. So I'm looking for an expansion for a finitely presented group. Well, in that case, finding a homomorphic expansion, so finding a multiplicative expansion, it's enough to define it on the generators because everything else is forced. So finding an expansion amounts to solving a system of equations, the values of the generators, and they have to satisfy the relations of the group. Okay? So it amounts to solving a system of equations which are defined in graded spaces. Namely, the equations are taking values, the unknowns are in A, in the target space of the expansion. So I need to solve a system of equations with which are written in graded spaces. And this is exactly the machine. Okay? You have a problem in topology, something that has to do with a group that describes topological objects. You look for an expansion for this group, and this amounts to solving some equations with unknowns. And then the theorem, which I will barely be able to state today, and which appears in joint papers by myself and Zhuzhana Dancho. By the way, the omega is defined at the top of the handout, and it's a URL. So if you go to omega/ZD, I don't remember where it goes, but probably it's a link to the paper. Okay? Alternatively, if you click on the PDF version of the handout. Okay? But anyway, the theorem says that there is a bijection between the set of homomorphic expansions for some specific set of topological objects, WK, and the set of solutions of the Kashiwara-Verne problems, which I described right at the beginning. Again, it's a problem about solving equations in graded spaces. And, well, the stuff in red is not a part of the theorem, but a further statement that I hereby make. This is the tip of a huge iceberg. Okay? Anyway, so next I want to describe what omega k is. Is this okay? Can I move on? Okay. So, omega k is a space of four-dimensional knots. So, knotted two-dimensional things in four dimensions. And I suppose I want to first introduce to you knotted two-dimensional things in four dimensions in several ways, because they're a bit hard to visualize. Okay? So, you know, maybe I should start with an eraser. Here's one. So, you know, you all know one-dimensional knots in R3, and the way you describe, one way to describe a one-dimensional knot in R3 is to project it to the plane, okay, and draw some picture in the plane. But in this picture, there are cuts. And the cuts, like there is a cut here, and the cut indicate that the string making the knot dips down to t is less than zero. And so for a moment I don't see it, and then it pops up again. So really here it dips down in the third dimension. Okay? So one way to describe four-dimensional knots is to do the same one dimension up. So here is an example of a four-dimensional knot. It's a surface embedded in R3, but there are cuts in the surface in various places, like here. And these cuts indicate that the side being cut dips down to t is less than zero. Okay? So I hereby claim that this is a knot in 4D. Let's understand it. Just very, very briefly. Okay? So very, very briefly, let's start understanding it from down here, going first to the right and then to the left. Okay? So if I look down here, I simply see a tube. Right? It's a tube in R3. Now, I go to the right, and it's still a tube. It bends, but it's a tube, it's a tube, it's a tube, it's a tube. The tube dips down and go under something. What this thing is, we will see later. But for now, it just goes under something, right? So it's still a tube. Then the tube thickens into a huge drum, right? This big blue drum here. And as it thickens, it goes over something. But topologically, a drum is just a tube, so it's still just a tube. Then the drum gets capped, and as it gets capped, it goes under something, right? Because it has a cut in it. Okay, what the thing that it goes under, we will see later. But in principle, all I had here was a very big tube that got thick at some point and got capped at some point and went under and over things, but it's basically just a tube. Okay? Now let's go in the other direction. So in the other direction, I still see a tube. The tube goes over something, becomes a big drum, and which sort of, you know, opens up like a flower, but it's still just a tube, and then it sort of has a branch going to the right, but that's still just a tube. And this branch goes over something, and then under something, and then it gets capped, and as it gets capped, it goes over something, but it's still just a tube. So overall, I got, going to the left, I also got a tube which gets capped. So overall, all I have is a long, long, long tube which is capped on both ends, so that's just a sphere. Okay? So here you go. Here is a sphere in R4. And you're welcome to try to unknot it, and you will fail because it genuinely is unknotted. Knotted. Okay? Now, here's another example. So this example, I use coordinates by my postdoc, Esther Dalvich, but who also is responsible for several other things, which we will see later. But anyway, it's this picture here at the top, and the picture at the top is, again, a surface in R3, and I use color to indicate height. So red is hot, so T is temperature is high, and blue is cold, so T is small, okay? So now it's a bit hard to visualize this one, so I cut it in half, and only showing half of it, okay? But the real knot is the thing above. And then again, it's very clear what we have here, right? We have a cap, which, and then a tube connected to it. The tube goes around and gets capped again, so again, it's a sphere, okay? And this sphere appears to have self-intersections, but at the self-intersection point, you know, one side is red, one side is green, so in four dimensions are separate. In the fourth dimensions are separated. So that's potentially a knot in 4D. Now, if this small thin tube in the middle, this one, the diagonal one, had been red from start to end, this would be the unknot. Because had it been red through, I could simply slide the cap out, and the cap is always under, because green is always under red in the T coordinate. So I could simply slide it out, had it been straight red throughout. But it isn't straight red. So by the intermediate value theorem, at some point, this shade of green would be exactly the same as that shade of green, and if I try to slide this out, I will actually have a clash. So this really is knotted, but proving it, of course, takes some effort. By the way, this knot is the same as that knot, but that also takes an effort. Okay. Then there is yet another way to describe two knots in R4, and this is as follows. So basically, you think of R4 as R3 cross time. So things in R4 are like movies of things in R3. Now, when you cut a two-dimensional thing in R4 into individual time slices, so this is when you slice, not when you project. So when you project, you get these things. But when you slice, you get a one-dimensional thing at each time slice. So at each time slice, generically, you will see a one-dimensional manifold, namely a ring. And as you turn on the time, the rings fly around in certain funny ways, and the flying around of rings is a knot in R4. So here's a nice video made by Esther, and perhaps it's the only thing I will show of the video type. So here are three rings flying around, one blue, yellow through red, then yellow and on blue trade places without going through, then, so again, maybe I'll do it again. So first yellow go through red, then yellow and blue trade places externally, then again there is a trading of places internally, and this is some knotting in R4, and here is the same knotting using the previous convention, using the projection convention. Okay? So this is not a complete knot, right? Because to complete it, I would have to connect the tops and the bottom in a certain, bottoms in a certain way, but I'm not bothering to do it. Are you okay? Good. Now, okay. Now I want to describe a certain big space of knotted objects in R3. And I'm going to, in R4, and I'm going to describe it using generators and relations. So I'll start with the generators. So the first generator is the so-called crossing, and the crossing is denoted in the plane by an ordinary crossing, but it does not mean an ordinary crossing as in ordinary knot theory. Rather, it stands for something else. It stands for what before I described as two rings flying through each other, two rings trading places by one flying through each other, through the other. So basically, it's red flying through blue, okay? So that is one description. Another description is this description shown here with cuts, and red first goes over one side of blue, then through blue, and then below the other side of blue. And, you know, if I had clicked on this place thing, you will see a little video, but I think I'd rather move on. And here is yet another description. So the last description is this double inflation procedure. So first of all, you take the crossing and you inflate it into this kind of a two-dimensional object. So two ribbons going through each other, and they actually intersect in R3. And then you inflate it a second time, and let me explain the second inflation. So you take a ribbon. The way you inflate a ribbon is as follows. You take a ribbon. Here is a ribbon, right? It's a part of a ribbon. Maybe I should make it sort of thinner so that it would look more like a ribbon. Here is a ribbon, okay? You make two copies of the ribbon, and you put them, so now you have two membranes, and you put them adjacent to each other in R3, and then you kind of pop it up, but you pop it in the third, in the fourth dimension. So you push one copy of the ribbon up in the fourth dimension, and the other copy down in the fourth dimension, while keeping the boundaries fixed, and while pushing the inner side, the inner parts, further than the side parts. So basically you get a tube, except the tube is sort of, you can't really see it because because it's in the T coordinates that I've inflated. So each of these membranes really represents a tube. Now the convention is that the middle get popped out the most. Now since this tube goes through the middle of the other one, so the intersection disappears because, well, actually I should have drawn this one a bit thinner so it gets popped out less. And it goes through this tube in the place where it gets popped out the most. So in the t-coordinate, there is never an intersection here. Okay? Good. Here is the next generator, the next type of four-dimensional crossing. It is indicated by a crossing without indicating which side is above and which side is below. One way of interpreting it is as two rings that trade places externally. Now you can ask, which way? Do they trade places this way or that way? And topologically, it doesn't matter because you can interpolate via trading places that way. So there is basically an S1 worth of ways of trading places, so the space of trading places is connected. So all trades are equivalent. Okay? Alternatively, I could view it as a picture like this in which red is above in both sides or under in both sides. And again, if I click on this play button, you'd see it, but I think I'll skip it. And finally, one view of it is to inflate it to first inflation to two ribbons that pass, you know, one above the other rather than one through the other. And then inflate each one to a tube in 4D. And again, in three dimensions, these two pictures are not equivalent. But once they get inflated to four dimensions, they become equivalent. Okay? Are you still with me? Were you ever with me? Okay. So this is the second generator. Here is the third. So the third is very simple. Basically, it's indicated by a line with a bullet at the end, and what it means is a cup. Take a tube and cup it at the end. And first inflation is this picture, and well, yeah, it's clear what it is. I don't need to say more. And then the last generator is a vertex. And it's a bit hard to visualize what the vertex is, but here is a partial explanation. So you have two rings, they fly, at some point they coincide, and then they continue flying together as a single ring. So one dimension down, this is the parallel of saying that instead of talking about knotted circles, I'm talking about knotted graphs. So I'm allowing myself to, instead of talking about knotted circles, I'm allowing myself to talk about graphs that are knotted in a certain way, so there are singularities at various places. This is the parallel singularity one dimension up. So two rings fly, coincide, and from that point they fly together. Just like I could view the same thing one dimension down as two points fly, coincide, and then fly together. Okay? There is a sign in the business, and this is the plus vertex. There is also a minus vertex. You don't want to know about it. Okay? And then the double inflation procedure is clearly defined on any picture made out of these ingredients. So, for example, if you take this picture, its double inflation will be, well, a cup, so here is one cup, here's the other cup, and a thin strand going diagonally, a thin tube going diagonally, and, well, basically this is a picture that we've seen before. So the picture that we've seen before is really described by this little lovely picture here. Okay? And then, what is WK? So, WK is the planar algebra, PA, the planar algebra, generated by the four generators I described before. So what is a planar algebra? A planar algebra is more or less like an algebra, except that you can compose things instead of just by putting them, you know, from left to right. You can compose them by putting them side by side in the plane in any way you want. So basically, the planar algebra generated by those four objects are all planar pictures that can be drawn using these four basic ingredients. Okay? So we've seen such pictures just a minute ago. Now, there is a formal definition of what a planar algebra is, but I think what I just said suffices. Okay? And then, sorry, it's not quite the planar algebra generated by these, but it's the planar algebra generated by these things modulo a number of local relations. And these local relations are, well, all of them are fun. So it's the Rademeister 2 moves, the Rademeister 3 moves, the Rademeister 4 moves, and there are several types of it. There is the virtual Rademeister 1, the virtual Rademeister 2, depending on whether you use honest crossings or virtual crossings when you do the when you play the Rademeister game. And each of these moves has a topological meaning. Each of these moves represents something in topology. So basically, maybe I'll go through the overcrossings commute relation, the one written here. So what does this relation mean? It means that if you have three flying rings and they trade places, this is probably the wrong projection of it. You know what? Maybe I'll just describe the relation by showing you the rings, and then you'll have to believe me that it corresponds to this picture. So here is the claim. So suppose I have one big ring and two small rings. So the two small rings can trade play. I need to. Sorry. No, I need a pedal to help.
With you both.
Pedro, you just hold this, okay? So the two small rings want to trade places and fly through the big ring. So it's clear they can that I can first trade places and then fly them through, or I can fly, in the wrong order. Now I fly them through and then trade places, okay? And the two things are topologically equivalent because they equally well could have traded places while being inside. Okay? That's sort of the interpolation. So that's enough. So this explains, as it turns out, this relation. This explains this relation. Okay? And all other relations have similar neat topological explanation, and maybe I should point out, actually, here's a different way to explain the same relation. So this is, after first inflation, it is kind of clear that you can slide the horizontal ribbon down, and after inflation, you'll get the same picture. Okay? Yes?
So is it correct that if you do the same construction, the planar algebra with just one crossing and then the usual...
you get the usual knot theory.
That's the usual.
Yes.
That's
so in fact, a good comment. So the usual knot theory is simply the subspace of this in which you use only the first generator and some subset of these relations. Okay? But I want to point out that there is some asymmetry in the relations. So... you can slide a wide strand. So basically you can slide an over strand from one side of a virtual crossing to the other, as shown here and explained topologically here, but you cannot do it with a thin slide, because if you try to slide a thin strand up, when it comes up on the other side, it comes out twisted. I think you can visualize it. It comes out like this red line over there. So there is some asymmetry in the relations. Anyway, but I did write the relations as I understand them. Now I should have added that WK is not just a planar algebra. It also has a few further operations. And the operations are, well, you can unzip along an annulus. So if you have two vertices connected by a grand, And this band could have been noted in some crazy way. I mean, this is only a sort of an indication of what it could be. Okay? But anyway, this band really means a tube in 4D. Now, if you have a tube in 4D, well, let's pretend this is a tube in 4D, I could replace it by two parallel copies. I could make two parallel copies of it, one inside the other, and then I could connect one copy to the things going to the right, and the other copy to the things going to the left. And what I get is simply a new link, okay, a new four-dimensional knotted graph, okay, in which a tube got replaced by two parallel tubes. Similarly, if I have a tube which if I have a vertex which connects to a cap, so this is really a disk four-dimensionally, right? Because it's a it's a tube that is capped at one end. I could replace this disk by two parallel copies and connect one to the tube on the left, the other to the tube on the right, and that's another operation that I can perform on two-dimensional nodes. So basically, the space of WK of two-dimensional nodes has a very rich algebraic structure. It has several multiplications, like the planar algebra multiplications, but it also has this pair of unary operations. Okay? And now let me tell you something that perhaps I should have said earlier. So this expansions machine, which I defined for groups, and I said it's ridiculously general because it was, you know, a generalization of the Taylor expansion, but to completely arbitrary groups, it is in fact ridiculously more general than that. Because as an input, I could have used any algebraic structure whatsoever, so long as you have operations, spaces on operations. So long as you have spaces on operations, you can look at formal linear combinations of things. You can extend the operations in a multilinear way. Extend the operations in a multilinear way to formal linear combinations of objects. Then you can look at formal linear combinations in which the sum of coefficients is equal to zero. Then you can look at, so this would be the parallel of the augmentation ideal. Then you can look at powers of the augmentation ideal, and powers would mean use all available operations to multiply. So the kth power of the augmentation ideal would mean use all available operations to multiply k things from the augmentation ideal. And then you get something which is hereby declared to be the kth power of the augmentation ideal. Then you can look at the associated graded, you can look at the expansions, and you can look for homomorphic expansions, so expansions that preserve the structure. And now the theorem with Danchov that I mentioned before makes sense. Now the statement makes sense. The statement is there is a bijection between the set of homomorphic expansions for this crazy space of four-dimensional things, two-dimensional knots in 4D with the operations in between them, and the set of solutions of Kashiwara-Verne, of the problem indicated before. So my challenge for the next four talks is to make it sound more plausible. So basically, to look at the associated graded and see that indeed it sometimes looks as if it is made out of pictures like the pictures appearing in this Frehley algebra description. Well, say more, basically. So that's my challenge for my next four talks, and I will not meet it. I will only come close to it. It will only sound a little more plausible. If you want the full details, you know, you'll have to click here. Okay? And I'll stop here with a little propaganda.
first question is, do you say that this planar algebra, modulo the relation, is exactly the isotopic classes of knotted surfaces, or what is the relation between the two?
So there are two lies in what I said. Again, this is a sketch, so, you know, there is truth behind everything, but there is also no some things that are not totally precise. Okay, first of all, this is this is not a lie, but I didn't quite highlight it, okay? So, this is definitely not the set of all knotted objects, all two-dimensional knotted objects in R4. It's a certain subset. Now, it's a subset that has a nice description, but it's still a subset. So, there are two ways to think about this subset. So, these are so-called ribbon two knots. So, in some sense, they bound nicely behaved three-dimensional objects. So, there are two knots. They bound nicely behaved three-dimensional objects with some prescribed singularities. That's one way to understand it. And the other way to understand it is as follows. So if you have a three-dimensional object and you project it to R3, you get a surface in R3, like this surface, okay? But it's a surface with singularities. So three types of singularities may occur. There are double points. So basically, if you two surfaces in R3 may intersect. There are triple points. So sometimes three surfaces will intersect at one point. And this is stable. If you deform it a little bit, it stays. It's generic. And finally, there is something called a branch point, which I don't want to talk about right now. Okay? Now, a simple two-knot is a two-knot in which there are only simple double points. No triple points and no branch points. So, so this is the subset that this describes. Now, you know, as an aside, there is a big open problem of whether everything extends to all two knots. And the evidence in favor comes from quantum field theory. Now, I will not state it, but on my third lecture, at least I will show how it's plausibly connected to quantum field theory. But there is evidence from quantum field theory that everything extends to arbitrary two knots, but it's not realized. It's not done. Okay? So that's, okay, that was one lie. The other lie was here. Not quite lie, but not full disclosure. So I said these are the relations. I didn't say that these are all the relations. And in fact, this is also an open problem. So the reason, it's open whether the parallel of Rademeister's theorem. Rademeister's theorem says that in for one-dimensional knots, there are three relations and that's it. So in the case of these two knots, there is a conjectured list of relations, but there is no theorem. So it could be, it's conceivable that there are more relations. There is a recent preprint by Kawauchi in which he proves something that's probably equivalent to this list of relations is all, but the preprint has not been read yet by enough people that I know, at least, to make me convinced that this is done. So it's, you know, somewhere in between open and not open.
So before we saw that the isotopic classes of knots are a subset only here.
Sorry?
Isotopic classes of knots were inside this picture, inside this general algebra, because you could interpret the randomized moves for knots inside these relations?
Yes. So,
is it easy to see how the space of knots fits inside this space of knot surfaces?
I'm not sure I fully understood you. But I basically told you what the double inflation map is. So there is a certain map which interprets every picture like this as a two-dimensional knotted object in R4. You sort of inflate it twice.
Okay?
So each such thing means a two-dimensional knotted object in R4. Now, this map of pictures to two-dimensional things in R4 is definitely not surjective. The target space is understood. It's these simple two knots. And it may or may not be injective. Okay? So, by the way, a lot of my talks, so most of my talks, so it's in fact talks 2, 3, and 4 will be back one dimension down where everything is fully rigorous. And in four dimensions, well, the theorem I stated is a theorem, but the bijection between the objects that the theorem describes and four-dimensional objects is not fully proven. Yes?
So this class of special knotted objects that you have, is it, do you come up with these relations to prove this theorem, or were they sort of...
No, they came before.
So they're sort of natural in...
So these, these relations were considered before. It's not the relations to prove the theorem. By the way, I mean, even if they were the relations to prove the theorem, that would be interesting. In other words, there are other sort of theorems of similar nature. So there are other theorems in which you have unknowns in graded spaces, similar nature, similar flavored graded spaces with equations in some other graded spaces. And sometimes you show me such a problem and I can tell you, oh, it comes from knot theory or it comes from free manifold topology or something. In a few examples, I can tell you that. And then there are other examples where I have a system of graded equations like this, which really feels like it should be coming from this machine, but I still don't know how. Regardless of whether the input to the machine is contrived or natural. Okay? In particular, quantization of Poisson manifolds is one such example. Deformation quantization of Poisson manifolds. Yes?
Any questions? Okay, so two things. Tomorrow's lecture is at 3 p.m.